Plate 36. Buenos Aires Bullock Wagons. Chapter 8. Plate 37. Fuegians and Wigwams. Chapter Index. Excursion to Colonia del Sacramiento. Value of an Estancia. Cattle, how counted. Singular breed of oxen. Perforated pebbles. Shepherd dogs. Horses broken in, gauchos riding. Character of inhabitants. Rio Plata. Flocks of butterflies. Aeronaut spiders. Phosphorescence of the sea. Port Desire. Guanaco. Port St. Julian. Geology of Patagonia. Fossil gigantic animal. Types of organization constant. Change in the zoology of America. Causes of extinction. Banda Oriental and Patagonia. Having been delayed for nearly a fortnight in the city, I was glad to escape on board a packet bound for Montevideo. A town in a state of blockade must always be a disagreeable place of residence. In this case, moreover, there were constant apprehensions from robbers within. The sentinels were the worst of all, for, from their office, and from having arms in their hands, they robbed with a degree of authority which other men could not imitate. Our passage was a very long and tedious one. The Plata looks like a noble estuary on the map, but is in truth a poor affair. The wide expanse of muddy water has neither grandeur nor beauty. At one time of the day, the two shores, both of which are extremely low, could just be distinguished from the deck. On arriving at Montevideo, I found that the Beagle would not sail for some time, so I prepared for a short excursion in this part of Banda Oriental. Everything which I have said about the country near Maldonado is applicable to Montevideo, but the land, with the one exception of the Green Mount, 450 feet high, from which it takes its name, is far more level. Very little of the undulating grassy plain is enclosed, but near the town there are a few hedge banks, covered with agaves, cacti, and fennel. November 14, 1833. We left Montevideo in the afternoon. I intended to proceed to Colonia del Sacramiento, situated on the northern bank of the Plata, and opposite to Buenos Aires, and thence, following up the Uruguay, to the village of Mercedes, on the Rio Negro, one of the many rivers of this name in South America, and from this point, to return direct to Montevideo. We slept at the house of my guide at Canelones. In the morning we rose early, in the hopes of being able to ride a good distance, but it was a vain attempt, for all the rivers were flooded. We passed in boats the streams of Canelones, St. Lucia, and San Jose, and thus lost much time. On a former excursion I crossed the Lucia, near its mouth, and I was surprised to observe how easily our horses, although not used to swim, passed over a width of at least 600 yards. On mentioning this at Montevideo, I was told that a vessel containing some mountebanks, and their horses, being wrecked in the Plata, one horse swam 7 miles to the shore. In the course of the day I was amused by the dexterity with which a gaucho forced a restive horse to swim river. He stripped off his clothes, and jumping on its back, rode into the water, till it was out of its depth, then slipping off over the crupper, he caught hold of the tail, and as often as the horse turned round the man frightened it back by splashing water in its face. As soon as the horse touched the bottom on the other side, the man pulled himself on, and was firmly seated, bridle in hand, before the horse gained the bank. A naked man on a naked horse is a fine spectacle. I had no idea how well the two animals suited each other. The tail of a horse is a very useful appendage. I have passed a river in a boat with 4 people in it, which was ferried across in the same way as the gaucho. If a man and horse have to cross a broad river, the best plan is for the man to catch hold of the pommel, or mane, and help himself with the other arm. We slept and stayed the following day at the post of Kufr. In the evening the postman or letter carrier arrived. He was a day after his time, owing to the Rio Rosario being flooded. It would not, however, be of much consequence, for, although he had passed through some of the principal towns in Banda Oriental, his luggage consisted of two letters. The view from the house was pleasing. An undulating green surface, with distant glimpses of the Plata. I find that I look at this province with very different eyes from what I did upon my first arrival. I recollect I then thought it singularly level, but now, after galloping over the pampas, my only surprise is, what could have induced me ever to have called it level? The country is a series of undulations, in themselves perhaps not absolutely great, but, as compared to the plains of St. Fe, real mountains. From these inequalities there is an abundance of small rivulets, and the turf is green and luxuriant. November 17, 1833. We crossed the Rosario, which was deep and rapid, and passing the village of Cola, arrived at midday at Colonia del Sacramento. The distance is 20 leagues, through a country covered with fine grass, but poorly stocked with cattle or inhabitants. I was invited to sleep at Colonia, and to accompany on the following day a gentleman to his estancia, where there were some limestone rocks. The town is built on a stony promontory something in the same manner as at Montevideo. It is strongly fortified, but both fortifications and town suffered much in the Brazilian War. It is very ancient, and the irregularity of the streets, and the surrounding groves of old orange and peach trees, gave it a pretty appearance. The church is a curious ruin. It was used as a powder magazine, and was struck by lightning in one of the 10,000 thunderstorms of the Rio Plata. Two-thirds of the building were blown away to the very foundation, and the rest stands a shattered and curious monument of the united powers of lightning and gunpowder. In the evening I wandered about the half-demolished walls of the town. It was the chief seat of the Brazilian War, a war most injurious to this country, not so much in its immediate effects, as in being the origin of a multitude of generals and all other grades of officers. More generals are numbered, but not paid in the United Provinces of La Plata, than in the United Kingdom of Great Britain. These gentlemen have learned to like power, and do not object to a little skirmishing. Hence there are many always on the watch to create disturbance, and to overturn a government which as yet has never rested on any stable foundation. I noticed, however, both here, and in other places, a very general interest in the ensuing election for the president, and this appears a good sign for the prosperity of this little country. The inhabitants do not require much education in their representatives. I heard some men discussing the merits of those for Colonia, and it was said that, although they were not men of business, they could all sign their names. With this they seemed to think every reasonable man ought to be satisfied. November 18, 1833. Rode with my host to his estancia, at the Arroyo de San Juan. In the evening we took a ride round the estate. It contained 2.5 square leagues, and was situated in what is called a rincon, that is, one side was fronted by the Plata, and the two others guarded by impassable brooks. There was an excellent port for little vessels, and an abundance of small wood, which is valuable as supplying fuel to Buenos Aires. I was curious to know the value of so complete an estancia. Of cattle there were 3,000, and it would well support 3 or 4 times that number, of mares 800, together with 150 broken-in horses, and 600 sheep. There was plenty of water and limestone, a rough house, excellent corrals, and a peach orchard. for all this he had been offered £2,000, and he only wanted £500 additional, and probably would sell it for less. The chief trouble with Anastasia is driving the cattle twice a week to a central spot, in order to make them tame, and to count them. This latter operation would be thought difficult, where there are 10 or 15,000 head together. It is managed on the principle that the cattle invariably divide themselves into little troops of from 40 to 100. Each troop is recognized by a few peculiarly marked animals, and its number is known, so that, one being lost out of 10,000, it is perceived by its absence from one of the tropillas. During a stormy night the cattle all mingle together, but the next morning the tropillas separate, as before, so that each animal must know its fellow out of 10,000 others. On two occasions I met within this province some oxen of a very curious breed, called Nata or Nyata. They appear externally to hold nearly the same relation to other cattle, which bull or pug dogs do to other dogs. Therefore it is very short and broad, with the nasal end turned up, and the upper lip much drawn back. Their lower jaws project beyond the upper, and have a corresponding upward curve, hence their teeth are always exposed. Their nostrils are seated high up and are very open, their eyes project outwards. When walking they carry their heads low, on a short neck, and their hinder legs are rather longer compared with the front legs, than is usual. Their bare teeth, their short heads, and upturned nostrils give them the most ludicrous self-confident air of defiance imaginable. Since my return, I have procured a skeleton head, through the kindness of my friend Captain Sullivan, R.N., which is now deposited in the College of Surgeons. 8/1. Mr. Walterhouse has drawn up a detailed description of this head, which I hope he will publish in some journal. Don F. Muniz, of Luxon, has kindly collected for me all the information which he could respecting this breed. From his account it seems that about 80 or 90 years ago, they were rare and kept as curiosities at Buenos Aires. The breed is universally believed to have originated amongst the Indians southward of the Plata, and that it was with them the commonest kind. Even to this day, those reared in the provinces near the Plata show their less civilized origin, in being fiercer than common cattle, and in the cow easily deserting her first calf, if visited too often, or molested. It is a singular fact that an almost similar structure to the abnormal one of the Nyata breed characterizes, as I am informed by Dr. Falconer, of that great extinct ruminant of India, the Cevisarium. 8/2. A nearly similar abnormal, but I do not know whether hereditary, structure has been observed in the carp, and likewise in the crocodile of the Ganges, Histoired as anomalies par emisede. Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire Tome 1 page 244. The breed is very true, and a Nyata, bull, and cow, invariably produce Nyata calves. A Nyata bull with a common cow, or the reverse cross, produces offspring having an intermediate character, but with the Nyata character strongly displayed, according to Sayor Muniz. There is the clearest evidence, contrary to the common belief of agriculturists in analogous cases, that the Nyata cow, when crossed with a common bull, transmits her peculiarities more strongly than the Nyata bull, when crossed with a common cow. When the pasture is tolerably long, the Nyata cattle feed with the tongue and palate as well as common cattle, but during the great droughts, when so many animals perish, the Nyata breed is under a great disadvantage, and would be exterminated if not attended to, for the common cattle, like horses, are able just to keep alive, by browsing with their lips on twigs of trees and reeds. This the Nyatas cannot so well do, as their lips do not join. And hence they are found to perish before the common cattle. This strikes me as a good illustration of how little we are able to judge from the ordinary habits of life, on what circumstances, occurring only at long intervals, the rarity or extinction of a species may be determined. November 19, 1833. Passing the valley of Las Vacas, we slept at a house of a North American who worked a lime kiln on the Arroyo de los Vivores. In the morning we rode to a projecting headland on the banks of the river called Punta Gorda. On the way we tried to find a jaguar. There were plenty of fresh tracks, and we visited the trees on which they are said to sharpen their claws, but we did not succeed in disturbing one. From this point the Rio Uruguay presented to our view a noble volume of water. From the clearness and rapidity of the stream, its appearance was far superior to that of its neighbor the Parana. On the opposite coast, several branches from the latter river entered the Uruguay. As the sun was shining, the two colors of the waters could be seen quite distinct. In the evening we proceeded on our road towards Mercedes on the Rio Negro. At night we asked permission to sleep at an estancia at which we happened to arrive. It was a very large estate, being 10 leagues square, and the owner is one of the greatest landowners in the country. His nephew had charge of it, and with him there was a captain in the army, who the other day ran away from Buenos Aires. Considering their station, their conversation was rather amusing. They expressed, as was usual, unbounded astonishment at the globe being round, and could scarcely credit that a hole would, if deep enough, come out on the other side. They had, however, heard of a country where there were 6 months of light and 6 of darkness, and where the inhabitants were very dull and thin. They were curious about the price and condition of horses and cattle in England. Upon finding out we did not catch our animals with the lazo, they cried out, then, you use nothing but the bolas. The idea of an enclosed country was quite new to them. The captain at last said he had one question to ask me, which he should be very much obliged if I would answer with all truth. I trembled to think how deeply scientific it would be. It was whether the ladies of Buenos Aires were not the handsomest in the world. I replied, like a renegade, charmingly so. He added, I have one other question, do ladies in any other part of the world wear such large combs? I solemnly assured him that they did not. They were absolutely delighted. The captain exclaimed, look there. A man who has seen half the world says it is the case. We always thought so, but now we know it. My excellent judgment in combs and beauty procured me a most hospitable reception. The captain forced me to take his bed, and he would sleep on his recado. November 21, 1833. Started at sunrise, and rode slowly during the whole day. The geological nature of this part of the province was different from the rest, and closely resembled that of the Pampas. In consequence, there were immense beds of the thistle, as well as of the cardoon. The whole country, indeed, may be called one great bed of these plants. The two sorts grow separate, each plant in company with its own kind. The cardoon is as high as a horse's back, but the Pampas thistle is often higher than the crown of the rider's head. To leave the road for a yard is out of the question, and the road itself is partly, and in some cases entirely, closed. Pasture, of course, there is none. If cattle or horses once enter the bed, they are for the time completely lost. Hence it is very hazardous to attempt to drive cattle at this season of the year, for when jaded enough to face the thistles, they rush among them, and are seen no more. In these districts there are very few estancias, and these few are situated in the neighborhood of damp valleys, where fortunately neither of these overwhelming plants can exist. As night came on, before we arrived at our journey's end, we slept at a miserable little hovel inhabited by the poorest people. The extreme though rather formal courtesy of our host and hostess considering their grade of life, was quite delightful. November 22, 1833. Arrive at an estancia on the Barcalo belonging to a very hospitable Englishman, to whom I had a letter of introduction from my friend Mr. Lum. I stayed here 3 days. One morning I rode with my host to the Sierra del Pedro Flaco, about 20 miles, up the Rio Negro. Nearly the whole country was covered with good oak coarse grass, which was as high as a horse's belly, yet there were square leagues without a single head of cattle. The province of Banda Oriental, if well stocked, would support an astonishing number of animals. At present the annual export of hides from Montevideo amounts to 300,000, and the home consumption, from waste, is very considerable. An estanciero told me that he often had to send large herds of cattle a long journey to a salting establishment, and that the tired beasts were frequently obliged to be killed and skinned, but that he could never persuade the gauchos to eat of them, and every evening a fresh beast was slaughtered for their suppers. The view of the Rio Negro from the Sierra was more picturesque than any other which I saw in this province. The river, broad, deep, and rapid, wound at the foot of a rocky precipitous cliff. A belt of wood followed its course, and the horizon terminated in the distant undulations of the turf plain. When in this neighborhood, I several times heard of the Sierra de los Cuentos, a hill distant many miles to the northward. The name signifies Hill of Beads. I was assured that vast numbers of little round stones, of various colors, each with a small cylindrical hole, are found there. Formerly the Indians used to collect them, for the purpose of making necklaces and bracelets, a taste, I may observe, which is common to all savage nations, as well as to the most polished. I did not know what to understand from this story, but upon mentioning it at the Cape of Good Hope to Dr. Andrew Smith, he told me that he recollected finding on the southeastern coast of Africa, about 100 miles to the eastward of St. John's River, some quartz crystals with their edges blunted from attrition, and mixed with gravel on the sea beach. Each crystal was about 5 lines in diameter, and from an inch and a half in length. Many of them had a small canal extending from one extremity to the other, perfectly cylindrical, and of a size that readily admitted a coarse thread, or a piece of fine catgut. Their color was red or dull white. The natives were acquainted with this structure in crystals. I have mentioned these circumstances because, although no crystallized body is at present known to assume this form, it may lead some future traveler to investigate the real nature of such stones. While staying at this estancia, I was amused with what I saw and heard of the shepherd dogs of the country. 8/3. M. A. Orbigny has given nearly a similar account of these dogs, Tome 1, page 175. When riding, it is a common thing to meet a large flock of sheep guarded by one or two dogs, at the distance of some miles from any house or man. I often wondered how so firm a friendship had been established. The method of education consists in separating the puppy, while very young, from the bitch, and in accustoming it to its future companions. Anu is held 3 or 4 times a day, for the little thing to suck, and a nest of wool is made for it in the sheep pen. At no time is it allowed to associate with other dogs, or with the children of the family. The puppy is, moreover, generally castrated, so that, when grown up, it can scarcely have any feelings in common with the rest of its kind. From this education it has no wish to leave the flock, and just as another dog will defend its master, man, so will these the sheep. It is amusing to observe, when approaching a flock, how the dog immediately advances barking, and the sheep all close in his rear, as if round the oldest ram. These dogs are also easily taught to bring home the flock at a certain hour in the evening. Their most troublesome fault, when young, is their desire of playing with the sheep, for in their sport they sometimes gallop their poor subjects most unmercifully. The shepherd dog comes to the house every day for some meat, and as soon as it is given him, he skulks away, as if ashamed of himself. On these occasions the house dogs are very tyrannical, and the least of them will attack and pursue the stranger. The minute, however, the latter has reached the flock, he turns round and begins to bark, and then all the house dogs take very quickly to their heels. In a similar manner a whole pack of the hungry wild dogs will scarcely ever, and I was told by some never, venture to attack a flock guarded by even one of these faithful shepherds. The whole account appears to me a curious instance of the pliability of the affections in the dog, and yet, whether wild or however educated, he has a feeling of respect or fear for those that are fulfilling their instinct of association. For we can understand on no principle the wild dogs being driven away by the single one with its flock, except that they consider, from some confused notion, that the one thus associated gains power, as if in company with its own kind. F. Cuvier has observed that all animals that readily enter into domestication consider man as a member of their own society, and thus fulfill their instinct of association. In the above case the shepherd dog ranks the sheep as its fellow brethren, and thus gains confidence, and the wild dogs, though knowing that the individual sheep are not dogs, but are good to eat, yet partly consent to this view, when seeing them in a flock with a shepherd dog at their head. One evening a domiter, a subduer of horses, came for the purpose of breaking in some colts. I will describe the preparatory steps, for I believe they have not been mentioned by other travelers. A troop of wild young horses is driven into the corral, or large enclosure of stakes, and the door is shut. We will suppose that one man alone has to catch and mount a horse, which has yet had never felt bridle or saddle. I conceive, except by a gaucho, such a feat would be utterly impracticable. The gaucho picks out a full-grown colt, and, as the beast rushes round the circus, he throws his lasso, so as to catch both the front legs. Instantly the horse rolls over with a heavy shock, and while struggling on the ground, the gaucho, holding the lasso tight, makes a circle, so as to catch one of the hind legs just beneath the fetlock, and draws it close to the two front legs. He then hitches the lasso, so that the three are bound together. Then sitting on the horse's neck, he fixes a strong bridle, without a bit, to the lower jaw. This he does by passing a narrow thong through the eye holes at the end of the reins, and several times round both jaw and tongue. The two front legs are now tied closely together with a strong leathern thong, fastened by a slip knot. The lasso, which bound the three together, being then loosed, the horse rises with difficulty. The gaucho, now holding fast the bridle fixed to the lower jaw, lets the horse outside the corral. If a second man is present, otherwise the trouble is much greater, he holds the animal's head, whilst the first puts on the horse cloths and saddle, and girths the whole together. During this operation, the horse, from dread and astonishment, at thus being bound round the waist, throws himself over and over again on the ground, and, till beaten, is unwilling to rise. At last, when the saddling is finished, the poor animal can hardly breathe from fear, and is white with foam and sweat. The man now prepares to mount by pressing heavily on the stirrup, so that the horse may not lose its balance, and at the moment that he throws his leg over the animal's back, he pulls the slip knot binding the front legs, and the beast is free. Some domadores pull the knot while the animal is lying on the ground, and, standing over the saddle, allow him to rise beneath them. The horse, wild with dread, gives a few most violent bounds, and then starts off at full gallop. When quite exhausted, the man, by patience, brings him back to the corral, where, reeking hot, and scarcely alive, the poor beast is let free. Those animals which will not gallop away, but obstinately throw themselves on the ground, are by far the most troublesome. This process is tremendously severe, but in two or three trials the horse is tamed. It is not, however, for some weeks that the animal is ridden with the iron bit and solid ring. For it must learn to associate the will of its rider with the feel of the rein before the most powerful bridle can be of any service. Animals are so abundant in these countries that humanity and self-interest are not closely united, therefore I fear it is that the former is here scarcely known. One day, riding in the pampas, with a very respectable estanciero, my horse, being tired, lagged behind. The man often shouted to me to spur him. When I remonstrated that it was a pity, for the horse was quite exhausted, he cried out, "Why not? Never mind, spur him, it is my horse." I had then some difficulty in making him comprehend that it was for the horse's sake, and not on his account, that I did not choose to use my spurs. He exclaimed, with a look of great surprise, "Ah, Don Carlos, qué cosa?" It was clear that such an idea had never before entered his head. The gauchos are well known to be perfect riders. The idea of being thrown, "Let the horse do what it likes," never enters their head. Their criterion of a good rider is a man who can manage an untamed colt, or who, if his horse falls, alights on his own feet, or can perform other such exploits. I have heard of a man betting that he would throw his horse down 20 times, and that 19 times he would not fall himself. I recollect seeing a gaucho riding a very stubborn horse, which 3 times successively reared so high as to fall backwards with great violence. The man judged with uncommon coolness the proper moment for slipping off, not an instant before or after the right time, and as soon as the horse got up, the man jumped on his back. And at last they started at a gallop. The gaucho never appears to exert any muscular force. I was one day watching a good rider as we were galloping along at the rapid pace, and thought to myself, "Surely, if the horse starts, you appear so careless on your seat, you must fall." At this moment a male ostrich sprang from its nest right beneath the horse's nose, the young colt bounded on one side, like a stag, but, as for the man, all that could be said was that he started and took fright with his horse. In Chile and Peru, more pains are taken with the mouth of the horse than in La Plata, and this is evidently a consequence of the more intricate nature of the country. In Chile a horse is not considered perfectly broken till he can be brought up standing. In the midst of his full speed, on any particular spot, for instance, on a cloak thrown on the ground, or, again, he will charge a wall, and rearing, scrape the surface with his hoofs. I have seen an animal bounding with spirit, yet merely reined by a forefinger and thumb, taken at full gallop across a courtyard, and then made to wheel round the post of a veranda with great speed, but at so equal a distance, that the rider, with outstretched arm, all the while kept one finger rubbing the post. Then making a demi-volt in the air, with the other arm outstretched in a like manner, he wheeled round, with astonishing force, in an opposite direction. Such a horse is well broken, and, although this at first may appear useless, it is far otherwise. It is only carrying that which is daily necessary into perfection. When a bullock is checked and caught by the lazo, it will sometimes gallop round and round, in a circle, and the horse being alarmed at the great strain, if not well broken, will not readily turn like the pivot of a wheel. In consequence many men have been killed, for if the lazo once takes a twist round a man's body, it will instantly, from the power of the two opposed animals, almost cut him in twain. On the same principle the races are managed, the courses only two or 300 yards long, the wish being to have horses that can make rapid dash. The race horses are trained not only to stand with their hoofs touching a line, but to draw all 4 feet together, so, as at the first spring, to bring into play the full action of the hind quarters. In Chile I was told an anecdote, which I believe was true, and it offers a good illustration of the use of a well-broken animal. A respectable man riding one day met two others, one of whom was mounted on a horse, which he knew to have been stolen from himself. He challenged them, they answered him by drawing their sabers, and giving chase. The man, on his good and fleet beast, kept just ahead. As he passed a thick bush he wheeled round it, and brought up his horse to a dead check. The pursuers were obliged to shoot on one side, and ahead. Then instantly dashing on, right behind them, he buried his knife in the back of one, wounded the other, recovered his horse from the dying robber, and rode home. For these feats of horsemanship two things are necessary: a most severe bit, like the Mameluke, the power of which, though seldom used, the horse knows full well, and large blunt spurs, that can be applied either as a mere touch, or as an instrument of extreme pain. I conceive that with English spurs, the slightest touch of which pricks the skin, it would be impossible to break in a horse, after the South American fashion. At Han Estancia near Las Vacas large numbers of mares are weekly slaughtered for the sake of their hides, although worth only 5 paper dollars, or about half a crown apiece. It seems at first strange that it can answer to kill mares for such a trifle, but, as it is thought ridiculous in this country ever to break in, or ride a mare, they are of no value except for breeding. The only thing for which I ever saw mares used, was to tread out wheat from the ear, for which purpose they were driven round a circular enclosure, where the wheat sheaves were strewed. The man employed for slaughtering the mares happened to be celebrated for his dexterity with the lasso. Standing at the distance of 12 yards, from the mouth of the corral, he has laid a wager, that he would catch by the legs every animal, without missing one, as it rushed past him. There was another man who said he would enter the corral on foot, catch a mare, fasten her front legs together, drive her out, throw her down, kill, skin, and stake the hide for drying, which latter is a tedious job, and he engaged that he would perform this whole operation on 22 animals in one day. Or he would kill, and take the skin off 50 in the same time. This would have been a prodigious task, for it is considered a good day's work, to skin and stake the hides of 15 or 16 animals. November 26, 1833. I set out on my return in a direct line for Montevideo. Having heard of some giant's bones at a neighboring farmhouse on the Sarandis, a small stream entering the Rio Negro, I rode there accompanied by my host, and purchased for the value of 18 pence the head of the Toxodon. 8/4. I must express my obligation to Mr. Keane, at whose house I was staying on a barcalo, and to Mr. Lum at Buenos Aires, for without their assistance these valuable remains would never have reached England. When found it was quite perfect, but the boys knocked out some of the teeth with stones, and then set up the head, as a mark to throw at. By a most fortunate chance I found a perfect tooth, which exactly fitted one of the sockets in this skull, embedded by itself on the banks of the Rio Tercero, at the distance of about 180 miles from this place. I found remains of this extraordinary animal at two other places, so that it must formerly have been common. I found here, also, some large portions of the armor of a gigantic armadillo-like animal, and part of the great head of a mylodon. The bones of this head are so fresh, that they contain, according to the analysis by Mr. T. Reeks, 7% of animal matter, and when placed in a spirit lamp, they burn with a small flame. the number of the remains embedded in the Grand Estuary deposit which forms the pampas and covers the granitic rocks of Banda Oriental must be extraordinarily great. I believe a straight line drawn in any direction through the pampas would cut through some skeleton or bones. Besides those which I found during my short excursions, I heard of many others, and the origin of such names as the stream of the animal, the hill of the giant, is obvious. At other times I heard of the marvelous property of certain rivers, which had the power of changing small bones into large, or, as some maintained, the bones themselves grew. As far as I am aware, not one of these animals perished, as was formerly supposed, in the marshes or muddy riverbeds of the present land, but their bones have been exposed by the streams intersecting the subaqueous deposit in which they were originally embedded. We may conclude that the whole area of the pampas is one wide sepulchre of these extinct gigantic quadrupeds. By the middle of the day, on the 28th, we arrived at Montevideo, having been 2 days and a half on the road. The country for the whole way was of a very uniform character, some parts being rather more rocky and hilly than near the Plata. Not far from Montevideo we passed through the village of Las Piedras, so named from some large rounded masses of syenite. Its appearance was rather pretty. In this country a few fig trees round a group of houses, and a site elevated 100 feet above the general level, ought always to be called picturesque. During the last 6 months I have had an opportunity of seeing a little of the character of the inhabitants of these provinces. The gauchos, or countrymen, are very superior to those who reside in the towns. The gaucho is invariably most obliging, polite, and hospitable. I did not meet with even one instance of rudeness or inhospitality. He is modest, both respecting himself and country, but at the same time a spirited, bold fellow. On the other hand, many robberies are committed, and there is much bloodshed. The habit of constantly wearing the knife is the chief cause of the latter. It is lamentable to hear how many lives are lost in trifling quarrels. In fighting, each party tries to mark the face of his adversary by slashing his nose or eyes, as is often attested by deep and horrid-looking scars. Robberies are a natural consequence of universal gambling, much drinking, and extreme indolence. At Mercedes I asked 2 men why they did not work. One gravely said the days were too long, the other that he was too poor. The number of horses and profusion of food are the destruction of all industry. Moreover, there are so many feast days, and again, nothing can succeed without it be begun when the moon is on the increase, so that half the month is lost from these 2 causes. Police and justice are quite inefficient. If a man who is poor commits murder and is taken, he will be imprisoned and perhaps even shot. But if he is rich, and has friends, he may rely on it no very severe consequence will ensue. It is curious that the most respectable inhabitants of the country invariably assist a murderer to escape. They seem to think that the individual sins against the government, and not against the people. A traveler has no protection besides his firearms, and the constant habit of carrying them is the main check to more frequent robberies. The character of the higher and more educated classes, who reside in the towns, partakes, but perhaps in a lesser degree, of the good parts of the gaucho, but is, I fear, stained by many vices of which he is free. Sensuality, mockery of all religion, and the grossest corruption, are far from uncommon. Nearly every public officer can be bribed. The head man in the post office sold forged government francs. The governor and prime minister openly combined to plunder the state. Justice, where gold came into play, was hardly expected by anyone. I knew an Englishman who went to the chief justice. He told me that, not then understanding the ways of the place, he trembled as he entered the room, and said, Sir, I have come to offer you 200 paper dollars, value about £5 sterling, if you will arrest before a certain time a man who has cheated me. I know it is against the law, but my lawyer, naming him, recommended me to take the step. The Chief Justice smiled acquiescence, thanked him, and the man before night was safe in prison. With this entire want of principle in many of the leading men, with a country full of ill-paid turbulent officers, the people yet hope that a democratic form of government can succeed. On first entering society in these countries, two or three features strike one as particularly remarkable. The polite and dignified manners pervading every rank of life, the excellent taste displayed by the women in their dresses, and the equality amongst all ranks. At the Rio Colorado, some men who kept the humblest shops used to dine with General Rosas. A son of the major at Bahia Blanca gained his livelihood by making paper cigars, and he wished to accompany me, as guide or servant, to Buenos Aires, but his father objected on the score of the danger alone. Many officers in the army can neither read nor write, yet all meet in society as equals. In Interrios, the sala consisted of only six representatives. One of them kept a common shop, and evidently was not degraded by the office. All this is what would be expected in a new country. Nevertheless, the absence of gentlemen by profession appears to an Englishman something strange. When speaking of these countries, the manner in which they have been brought up by their unnatural parent, Spain, should always be borne in mind. On the whole, perhaps, more credit is due for what has been done than blame for that which may be deficient. It is impossible to doubt but that the extreme liberalism of these countries must ultimately lead to good results. The very general toleration of foreign religions, the regard paid to the means of education, the freedom of the press, the facilities offered to all foreigners, and especially, as I am bound to add, to everyone professing the humblest pretensions to science, should be recollected with gratitude by those who have visited Spanish South America. December 6, 1833. The Beagle sailed from the Rio Plata, never again to enter its muddy stream. Our course was directed to Port Desire, on the coast of Patagonia. Before proceeding any farther, I will here put together a few observations made at sea. Several times when the ship has been some miles off the mouth of the Plata, and at other times, when off the shoals of northern Patagonia, we have been surrounded by insects. One evening when we were about 10 miles from the Bay of San Blas, vast numbers of butterflies, in bands or flocks of countless myriads, extended as far as the eye could range. Even by the aid of a telescope it was not possible to see a space free from butterflies. The seamen cried out it was snowing butterflies, and such in fact was the appearance. More species than one were present, but the main part belonged to a kind very similar to, but not identical with, the common English Coleus sedusa. Some moths and Hymenoptera accompanied the butterflies, and a fine beetle, Calosoma, flew on board. Other instances are known of this beetle having been caught far out at sea, and this is the more remarkable, as the greater number of the Carabida seldom or never take wing. The day had been fine and calm, and the one previous to it equally so, with light and variable airs. Hence we cannot suppose that the insects were blown off the land, but we must conclude that they voluntarily took flight. The great bands of the Coleus seem at first to afford an instance, like those on record of the migrations of another butterfly, Vanessa Carduic, 8/5. Lyell's Principles of Geology, Volume 3, page 63. But the presence of other insects makes the case distinct, and even less intelligible. before sunset a strong breeze sprung up from the north, and this must have caused tens of thousands of the butterflies and other insects to have perished. On another occasion, when 17 miles off Cape Corrientes, I had to net overboard to catch pelagic animals. Upon drawing it up, to my surprise I found a considerable number of beetles in it, and, although in the open sea, they did not appear much injured by the salt water. I lost some of the specimens, but those which I preserved belonged to the genera Colymbates, Hydripolaris, Hydribias, two species, Nodiphus, Sinucus, Adamonia, and Scarabias. At first I thought that these insects had been blown from the shore, but upon reflecting that out of the 8 species 4 were aquatic, and 2 others partly so in their habits, it appeared to me most probable that they were floated into the sea by a small stream which drains a lake near Cape Corrientes. On any supposition, it is an interesting circumstance to find live insects swimming in the open ocean 17 miles from the nearest point of land. There are several accounts of insects having been blown off the Patagonian shore. Captain Cook observed it, as did more lately Captain King of the Adventure. The cause probably is due to the want of shelter, both of trees and hills, so that an insect on the wing with an offshore breeze would be very apt to be blown out to sea. The most remarkable instance I have known of an insect being caught far from the land was that of a large grasshopper, Acrodium, which flew on board when the Beagle was to windward of the Cape de Verde Islands, and when the nearest point of land, not directly opposed to the trade wind, was Cape Blanco, on the coast of Africa, 370 miles distant. 8/6. The flies which frequently accompany a ship for some days on its passage from harbor to harbor, wandering from the vessel, are soon lost, and all disappear. On several occasions, when the Beagle has been within the mouth of the Plata, the rigging has been coated with the web of the gossamer spider. One day, November 1, 1832, I paid particular attention to the subject. The weather had been fine and clear, and in the morning the air was full of patches of the flocculent web, as on an autumnal day in England. The ship was 60 miles distant from the land, in the direction of a steady though light breeze. Vast numbers of a small spider, about 1/10 of an inch in length, and of a dusky red color, were attached to the webs. There must have been, I should suppose, some thousands on the ship. The little spider, when first coming in contact with the rigging, was always seated on a single thread, and not on the flocculent mass. This latter seems merely to be produced by the entanglement of the single threads. The spiders were all of one species, but of both sexes, together with young ones. These latter were distinguished by their smaller size and more dusky color. I will not give the description of this spider, but merely state that it does not appear to me to be included in any of Latreille's genera. The little aeronaut, as soon as it arrived on board, was very active, running about, sometimes letting itself fall, and then reascending the same thread, sometimes employing itself in making a small and very irregular mesh in the corners between the ropes. It could run with facility on the surface of water. When disturbed, it lifted up its front legs in the attitude of attention. On its first arrival, it appeared very thirsty, and with exerted maxillae, drank eagerly of drops of water. This same circumstance has been observed by Strack. May it not be in consequence of the little insect having passed through a dry and rarefied atmosphere? Its stock of web seemed inexhaustible. While watching some that were suspended by a single thread, I several times observed that the slightest breath of air bore them away out of sight, in a horizontal line. On another occasion, 25th, under similar circumstances, I repeatedly observed the same kind of small spider, either when placed, or having crawled on some little eminence, elevate its abdomen, send forth a thread, and then sail away horizontally, but with a rapidity which was quite unaccountable. I thought I could perceive that the spider, before performing the above preparatory steps, connected its legs together with the most delicate threads, but I am not sure whether this observation was correct. One day, at St. Fay, I had a better opportunity of observing some similar facts. A spider which was about 3/10 of an inch in length, and which in its general appearance resembled a CT grade, therefore quite different from the gossamer, while standing on the summit of a post, darted forth 4 or 5 threads from its spinners. These, glittering in the sunshine, might be compared to diverging rays of light. They were not, however, straight, but in undulations, like films of silk blown by the wind. They were more than a yard in length, and diverged in an ascending direction from the orifices. The spider then suddenly let go its hold of the post, and was quickly borne out of sight. The day was hot, and apparently quite calm, yet under such circumstances, the atmosphere can never be so tranquil as not to affect a vein so delicate as the thread of a spider's web. If during a warm day we look either at the shadow of any object cast on a bank, or over a level plain, at a distant landmark, the effect of an ascending current of heated air is almost always evident. Such upward currents, it has been remarked, are also shown by the ascent of soap bubbles, which will not rise in an indoors room. Hence I think there is not much difficulty in understanding the ascent of the fine lines projected from a spider's spinners, and afterwards of the spider itself. The divergence of the lines has been attempted to be explained, I believe, by Mr. Murray, by their similar electrical condition. The circumstance of spiders of the same species, but of different sexes and ages, being found on several occasions at the distance of many leagues from the land, attached in vast numbers to the lines, renders it probable that the habit of sailing through the air is as characteristic of this tribe as that of diving is of the Argyroneta. We may then reject Latreille's supposition that the gossamer owes its origin indifferently to the young of several genera of spiders, although, as we have seen, the young of other spiders do possess the power of performing aerial voyages. 8/7. Mr. Blackwall in his researches in zoology has many excellent observations on the habits of spiders. During our different passages south of the Plata, I often towed a stern net made of bunting, and thus called many curious animals. Of Crustacea, there were many strange and undescribed genera. One, which in some respects is allied to the notopods, or those crabs which have their posterior legs placed almost on their backs, for the purpose of adhering to the underside of rocks, is very remarkable from the structure of its hind pair of legs. The penultimate joint, instead of terminating in a simple claw, ends in 3 bristle-like appendages of dissimilar lengths, the longest equaling that of the entire leg. These claws are very thin, and are serrated with the finest teeth, directed backwards. Their curved extremities are flattened, and on this part 5 most minute cups are placed, which seem to act in the same manner as the suckers on the arms of the cuttlefish. As the animal lives in the open sea, and probably wants a place of rest, I suppose this beautiful land most anomalous structure is adapted to take hold of floating marine animals. In deep water, far from the land, the number of living creatures is extremely small. South of the latitude 35 degrees, I never succeeded in catching anything besides some biro, and a few species of minute Entomostracus crustacea. In shoaler water, at the distance of a few miles from the coast, very many kinds of crustacea, and some other animals are numerous, but only during the night. Between latitudes 56 and 57 degrees south of Cape Horn, the net was put astern several times. It never, however, brought up anything besides a few of 2 extremely minute species of Entomostraca. Yet whales and seals, petrels, and albatross are exceedingly abundant throughout this part of the ocean. It has always been a mystery to me on what the albatross, which lives far from the shore, can subsist. I presume that, like the condor, it is able to fast long, and that one good feast on the carcass of a putrid whale lasts for a long time. The central and intertropical parts of the Atlantic swarm with Pteropoda, Crustacea, and Radiata, and with their devourers the flying fish, and again with their devourers the bonitos and albacores. I presume that the numerous lower pelagic animals feed on the infusoria, which are now known, from the researches of Ehrenberg, to abound in the open ocean, but on what, in the clear blue water, do these infusoria subsist? While sailing a little south of the Plata on one very dark night, the sea presented a wonderful and most beautiful spectacle. There was a fresh breeze, and every part of the surface, which during the day is seen as foam, now glowed with a pale light. The vessel drove before her bow with two billows of liquid phosphorus, and in her wake she was followed by a milky train. As far as the eye reached, the crest of every wave was bright, and the sky, above the horizon, from the reflected glare of these livid flames, was not so utterly obscure as over the vault of the heavens. As we proceed farther southward, the sea is seldom phosphorescent, and off Cape Horn I do not recollect more than once having seen it so, and then it was far from being brilliant. This circumstance probably has a close connection with the scarcity of organic beings in that part of the ocean. After the elaborate paper by Ehrenberg on the phosphorescence of the sea, it is almost superfluous on my part to make any observations on the subject. 8/8. An abstract is given in number 4 of the Magazine of Zoology and Botany. I may, however, add that the same torn and irregular particles of gelatinous matter described by Ehrenberg seem in the southern as well as in the northern hemisphere to be the common cause of this phenomenon. The particles were so minute as easily to pass through fine gauze, yet many were distinctly visible by the naked eye. The water when placed in a tumbler and agitated gave out sparks, but a small portion in a watch glass scarcely ever was luminous. Ehrenberg states that these particles all retain a certain degree of irritability. My observations, some of which were made directly after taking up the water, gave a different result. I may also mention that having used the net during one night, I allowed it to become partially dry, and having occasion 12 hours afterwards to employ it again, I found the whole surface sparkled as brightly as when first taken out of the water. It does not appear probable in this case that the particles could have remained so long alive. On one occasion, having kept a jellyfish of the genus DNA out till it was dead, the water in which it was placed became luminous. When the waves scintillate with bright green sparks, I believe it is generally owing to minute crustacea. But there can be no doubt that very many other pelagic animals, when alive, are phosphorescent. On two occasions I have observed the sea luminous at considerable depths beneath the surface. Near the mouth of the Plata, some circular and oval patches, from 2 to 4 yards in diameter, and with defined outlines, shone with a steady but pale light, while the surrounding water only gave out a few sparks. The appearance resembled the reflection of the moon, or some luminous body, for the edges were sinuous from the undulations of the surface. The ship, which drew 13 feet water, passed over without disturbing these patches. Therefore we must suppose that some animals were congregated together at a greater depth than the bottom of the vessel. Near Fernando Noronovici gave out light in flashes. The appearance was very similar to that which might be expected from a large fish moving rapidly through a luminous fluid. To this cause the sailors attributed it. At the time, however, I entertained some doubts on account of the frequency and rapidity of the flashes. I have already remarked that the phenomenon is very much more common in warm than in cold countries, and I have sometimes imagined that a disturbed electrical condition of the atmosphere was most favorable to its production. Certainly, I think the sea is most luminous after a few days of more calm weather than ordinary, during which time it has swarmed with various animals. Observing that the water charged with gelatinous particles is in an impure state, and that the luminous appearance, in all common cases, is produced by the agitation of the fluid in contact with the atmosphere, I am inclined to consider that the phosphorescence is the result of the decomposition of the organic particles, by which process, one is tempted almost to call it a kind of respiration, the ocean becomes purified. December 23, 1833. We arrived at Port Desire, situated in latitude 47 degrees, on the coast of Patagonia. The creek runs for about 20 miles inland, with an irregular width. The Beagle anchored a few miles within the entrance, in front of the ruins of an old Spanish settlement. The same evening I went on shore. The first landing in any new country is very interesting, and especially when, as in this case, the whole aspect bears the stamp of a marked and individual character. At the height of between 200 and 300 feet, above some masses of porphyry, the wide plain extends, which is truly characteristic of Patagonia. The surface is quite level, and is composed of well-rounded shingle mixed with the whitish earth. Here and there scattered tufts of brown wiry grass are supported, and still more rarely, some low thorny bushes. The weather is dry and pleasant, and the fine blue sky is, but seldom obscured. When standing in the middle of one of these desert plains, and looking towards the interior, the view is generally bounded by the escarpment of another plain, rather higher, but equally level and desolate, and in every other direction the horizon is indistinct from the trembling mirage which seems to rise from the heated surface. In such a country the fate of the Spanish settlement was soon decided. The dryness of the climate during the greater part of the year, and the occasional hostile attacks of the wandering Indians, compelled the colonists to desert their half-finished buildings. The style, however, in which they were commenced shows the strong and liberal hand of Spain, in the old time. The result of all the attempts to colonize this side of America south of 41 degrees has been miserable. Port famine expresses by its name the lingering and extreme sufferings of several hundred wretched people, of whom one alone survived to relate their misfortunes. At St. Joseph's Bay, on the coast of Patagonia, a small settlement was made, but during one Sunday the Indians made an attack, and massacred the whole party, excepting two men, who remained captives during many years. At the Rio Negro I conversed with one of these men, now in extreme old age. Plate 38. Opuntia darwinii. The zoology of Patagonia is as limited as its flora. 8/9. I found here a species of cactus, described by Professor Henslow, under the name of Opuntia darwinii, Magazine of Zoology and Botany, Volume 1, page 466, which was remarkable for the irritability of the stamens when I inserted either a piece of stick or the end of my finger in the flower. The segments of the perianth also closed on the pistil, but more slowly than the stamens. Plants of this family, generally considered as tropical, occur in North America, Lewis and Clark's Travels, page 221, in the same high latitude as here, namely, in both cases, in 47 degrees. On the arid plains a few black beetles, Heteromera, might be seen slowly crawling about, and occasionally a lizard darted from side to side. Of birds we have three carrion hawks, and in the valleys a few finches and insect feeders. An ibis, Pterosticus melanops, a species said to be found in Central Africa, is not uncommon on the most desert parts. In their stomachs I found grasshoppers, cicadae, small lizards, and even scorpions. 8/10. These insects were not uncommon beneath stones. I found one cannibal scorpion quietly devouring another. At one time of the year these birds go in flocks, at another in pairs. Their cry is very loud and singular, like the neighing of the guanaco. The guanaco, or wild llama, is the characteristic quadruped of the plains of Patagonia. It is the South American representative of the camel of the East. It is an elegant animal in a state of nature, with a long slender neck and fine legs. It is very common over the whole of the temperate parts of the continent, as far south as the islands near Cape Horn. It generally lives in small herds of from half a dozen to 13 each, but on the banks of the St. Cruz we saw one herd which must have contained at least 500. They are generally wild and extremely wary. Mr. Stokes told me that he one day saw through a glass a herd of these animals which evidently had been frightened and were running away at full speed, although their distance was so great that he could not distinguish them with his naked eye. The sportsman frequently receives the first notice of their presence by hearing from a long distance their peculiar shrill neighing note of alarm. If he then looks attentively, he will probably see the herd standing in a line on the side of some distant hill. On approaching nearer, a few more squeals are given, and off they set at an apparently slow, but really quick canter, along some narrow beaten track to a neighboring hill. If, however, by chance he abruptly meets a single animal, or several together, they will generally stand motionless, and intently gaze at him, then perhaps move on a few yards, turn round, and look again. What is the cause of this difference in their shyness? Do they mistake a man in the distance for their chief enemy, the puma? Or does curiosity overcome their timidity? That they are curious is certain, for if a person lies on the ground and plays strange antics, such as throwing up his feet in the air, they will almost always approach by degrees to reconnoiter him. It was an artifice that was repeatedly practiced by our sportsmen with success, and it had moreover the advantage of allowing several shots to be fired, which were all taken as parts of the performance. On the mountains of Tierra del Fuego, I have more than once seen a guanaco, on being approached, not only neigh and squeal, but prance and leap about in the most ridiculous manner, apparently in defiance, as a challenge. These animals are very easily domesticated, and I have seen some thus kept in northern Patagonia, near a house, though not under any restraint. They are in this state very bold, and readily attack a man by striking him from behind with both knees. It is asserted that the motive for these attacks is jealousy on account of their females. The wild guanacos, however, have no idea of defense. Even a single dog will secure one of these large animals till the huntsman can come up. In many of their habits they are like sheep in a flock. Thus when they see men approaching in several directions on horseback, they soon become bewildered and know not which way to run. This greatly facilitates the Indian method of hunting, for they are thus easily driven to a central point and are encompassed. The guanacos readily take to the water. Several times at Port Valdez they were seen swimming from island to island. Byron, in his voyage, says he saw them drinking salt water. Some of our officers likewise saw a herd apparently drinking the briny fluid from a saline near Cape Blanco. I imagine in several parts of the country, if they do not drink salt water, they drink none at all. In the middle of the day they frequently roll in the dust, in saucer-shaped hollows. The males fight together. 2. One day pass quite close to me, squealing and trying to bite each other, and several were shot with their hides deeply scored. herd sometimes appear to set out on exploring parties at Bahia Blanca, where, within 30 miles of the coast, these animals are extremely unfrequent. I one day saw the tracks of 30 or 40, which had come in a direct line to a muddy saltwater creek. They then must have perceived that they were approaching the sea, for they had wheeled with the regularity of cavalry, and had returned back in as straight a line as they had advanced. The guanacos have one singular habit, which is to me quite inexplicable, namely, that on successive days they drop their dung in the same defined heap. I saw one of these heaps which was 8 feet in diameter, and was composed of a large quantity. This habit, according to M.A. Orbigny, is common to all the species of the genus. It is very useful to the Peruvian Indians, who use the dung for fuel, and are thus saved the trouble of collecting it. The guanacos appear to have favorite spots for lying down to die. On the banks of the St. Cruz, in certain circumscribed spaces, which were generally bushy, and all near the river, the ground was actually white with bones. On one such spot I counted between 10 and 20 heads. I particularly examined the bones. They did not appear, as some scattered ones which I had seen, gnawed or broken, as if dragged together by beasts of prey. The animals in most cases must have crawled, before dying, beneath and amongst the bushes. Mr. Bino informs me that during a former voyage he observed the same circumstance on the banks of the Rio Gallegos. I do not at all understand the reason of this, but I may observe that the wounded guanacos at the St. Cruz invariably walk towards the river. At St. Jago in the Cape de Verde Islands, I remember having seen in a ravine a retired corner covered with bones of the goat. We at the time exclaimed that it was the burial ground of all the goats in the island. I mention these trifling circumstances, because in certain cases they might explain the occurrence of a number of uninjured bones in a cave, or buried under alluvial accumulations, and likewise the cause why certain animals are more commonly embedded than others in sedimentary deposits. None can reply. All seems eternal now. The wilderness has a mysterious dung, which teaches awful doubt. 8/11. Shelley, Lines on Mount Blanc. One day the yawl was sent under the command of Mr. Chaffers, with 3 days' provisions, to survey the upper part of the harbor. In the morning we searched for some watering places mentioned in an old Spanish chart. We found one creek, at the head of which there was a trickling rill, the first we had seen, of brackish water. Here the tide compelled us to wait several hours, and in the interval I walked some miles into the interior. The plain as usual consisted of gravel, mingled with soil resembling chalk in appearance, but very different from it in nature. From the softness of these materials it was worn into many gullies. There was not a tree, and, excepting the guanaco, which stood on the hilltop a watchful sentinel over its herd, scarcely an animal, or a bird. All was stillness and desolation. Yet in passing over these scenes, without one bright object near, an ill-defined, but strong sense of pleasure is vividly excited. One asked how many ages the plain had thus lasted, and how many more it was doomed thus to continue. In the evening we sailed a few miles farther up, and then pitched the tents for the night. By the middle of the next day the yawl was aground, and from the shoalness of the water could not proceed any higher. The water being found partly fresh, Mr. Chaffers took the dinghy, and went up 2 or 3 miles farther, where she also grounded, but in a fresh water river. The water was muddy, and though the stream was most insignificant in size, it would be difficult to account for its origin, except from the melting snow on the Cordillera. At the spot where we bivouacked, we were surrounded by bold cliffs and steep pinnacles of porphyry. I do not think I ever saw a spot which appeared more secluded from the rest of the world than this rocky crevice, in the wide plain. the second day after our return to the anchorage, a party of officers and myself went to Ranzac, an old Indian grave, which I had found on the summit of a neighboring hill. Two immense stones, each probably weighing at least a couple of tons, had been placed in front of a ledge of rock about 6 feet high. At the bottom of the grave on the hard rock there was a layer of earth about a foot deep, which must have been brought up from the plain below. Above it a pavement of flat stones was placed, on which others were piled, so as to fill up the space between the ledge and the two great blocks. To complete the grave, the Indians had contrived to detach from the ledge a huge fragment, and to throw it over the pile so as to rest on the two blocks. We undermined the grave on both sides, but could not find any relics, or even bones. The latter probably had decayed long since, in which case the grave must have been of extreme antiquity, for I found in another place some smaller heaps, beneath which a very few crumbling fragments could yet be distinguished, as having belonged to a man. Falconer states that where an Indian dies he is buried, but that subsequently his bones are carefully taken up and carried, let the distance be ever so great, to be deposited near the sea coast. This custom, I think, may be accounted for by recollecting that, before the introduction of horses, these Indians must have led nearly the same life as the Fuegians now do, and therefore generally have resided in the neighborhood of the sea. The common prejudice of lying where one's ancestors have lain would make the now roaming Indians bring the less perishable part of their dead to their ancient burial ground on the coast. January 9, 1834. Before it was dark the Beagle anchored in the fine spacious harbor of Port St. Julian, situated about 110 miles to the south of Port Desire. We remained here 8 days. The country is nearly similar to that of Port Desire, but perhaps rather more sterile. One day a party accompanied Captain Fitzroy on a long walk round the head of the harbor. We were 11 hours without tasting any water, and some of the party were quite exhausted. From the summit of a hill, since well named Thirsty Hill, a fine lake was spied, and two of the party proceeded with concerted signals to show whether it was fresh water. What was our disappointment to find a snow-white expanse of salt, crystallized in great cubes. We attributed our extreme thirst to the dryness of the atmosphere. But whatever the cause might be, we were exceedingly glad late in the evening to get back to the boats. Although we could nowhere find, during our whole visit, a single drop of fresh water, yet some must exist, for by an odd chance I found on the surface of the salt water, near the head of the bay, a colymbatus not quite dead, which must have lived in some not far distant pool. 3 other insects. A cinchandella, like Hybrida, a commendus, and a harpalus, which all live on muddy flats occasionally overflowed by the sea, and 1 other found dead on the plain, complete the list of the beetles. A good-sized fly, Tabanus, was extremely numerous, and tormented us by its painful bite. The common horsefly, which is so troublesome in the shady lanes of England, belongs to the same genus. We here have the puzzle that so frequently occurs in the case of mosquitoes on the blood of what animals do these insects commonly feed. The guanaco is nearly the only warm-blooded quadruped, and it is found in quite inconsiderable numbers compared with a multitude of flies. The geology of Patagonia is interesting. Differently from Europe, where the tertiary formations appear to have accumulated in bays, here along hundreds of miles of coast we have one great deposit, including many tertiary shells, all apparently extinct. The most common shell is a massive gigantic oyster, sometimes even a foot in diameter. These beds are covered by others of a peculiar soft white stone, including much gypsum, and resembling chalk, but really of a pumiceous nature. It is highly remarkable, from being composed, to at least 1/10 part of its bulk of infusoria. Professor Ehrenberg has already ascertained in it 30 oceanic forms. The spread extends for 500 miles along the coast, and probably for a considerably greater distance. At Port St. Julian its thickness is more than 800 feet. These white beds are everywhere kept by a mass of gravel, forming probably one of the largest beds of shingle in the world. It certainly extends from near the Rio Colorado to between 600 and 700 nautical miles southward. At Santa Cruz, a river a little south of St. Julian, it reaches to the foot of the Cordillera. Halfway up the river its thickness is more than 200 feet. It probably everywhere extends to this great chain. Once the well-rounded bevels of porphyry have been derived, we may consider its average breadth as 200 miles, and its average thickness as about 50 feet. If this great bed of pebbles, without including the mud necessarily derived from their attrition, was piled into a mound, it would form a great mountain chain. When we consider that all these pebbles, countless as the grains of sand in the desert, have been derived from the slow falling of masses of rock on the old coastlines and banks of rivers, and that these fragments have been dashed into smaller pieces, and that each of them has since been slowly rolled, rounded, and far transported, the mind is stupefied in thinking over the long, absolutely necessary, lapse of years. Yet all this gravel has been transported, and probably rounded, subsequently to the deposition of the white beds, and long subsequently to the underlying beds with the tertiary shales. Everything in this southern continent has been affected on a grand scale. The land, from the Rio Plata to Tierra del Fuego, a distance of 1,200 miles, has been raised in mass, and in Patagonia, to a height of between 300 and 400 feet, within the period of the now existing sea shells. The old and weathered shells left on the surface of the upraised plain still partially retain their colors. The uprising movement has been interrupted by at least 8 long periods of rest, during which the sea ate deeply back into the land, forming at successive levels the long lines of cliffs or escarpments, which separate the different plains, as they rise like steps one behind the other. The elevatory movement, and the eating back power of the sea, during the periods of rest, have been equable over long lines of coast, for I was astonished to find that the step, like plains stand at nearly corresponding heights at far distant points. The lowest plain is 90 feet high, and the highest, which I ascended near the coast, is 950 feet, and of this only relics are left in the form of flat gravel-capped hills. The upper plain of Santa Cruz slopes up to a height of 3,000 feet, at the foot of the Cordillera. I have said that within the period of existing sea shells, Patagonia has been upraised 300 to 400 feet. I may add that within the period when icebergs transported boulders over the upper plain of Santa Cruz, the elevation has been at least 1,500 feet. Nor has Patagonia been affected only by upward movements. The extinct tertiary shells from Port St. Julian and Santa Cruz cannot have lived, according to Professor E. Forbes, in a greater depth of water than from 40 to 250 feet. But they are now covered with sea, deposited strata from 800 to 1,000 feet in thickness, hence the bed of the sea, on which these shells once lived, must have sunk downward several hundred feet, to allow of the accumulation of the superincumbent strata. What a history of geological changes does the simply constructed coast of Patagonia reveal! Plate 39. Rays Beaches, Patagonia. At Port St. Julian, in some red mud capping the gravel on the 90-foot plain, I found half the skeleton of the Macrauchenia potachonica, a remarkable quadruped, full as large as a camel. 8/12. I have lately heard that Captain Sullivan, R.N., has found numerous fossil bones embedded in regular strata on the banks of the Archipelagos in latitude 51 degrees 4. Some of the bones are large, others are small, and appear to have belonged to an armadillo. This is a most interesting and important discovery. It belongs to the same division of the Pachydermata with the rhinoceros, tapir, and Paleotherium, but in the structure of the bones of its long neck it shows a clear relation to the camel, or rather to the guanaco and llama. From recency, shells being found on two of the higher step-formed plains, which must have been modeled and upraised before the mud was deposited in which the Macrauchenia was entombed, it is certain that this curious quadruped lived long after the sea was inhabited by its present shells. I was at first much surprised how a large quadruped could so lately have subsisted, in latitude 49 degrees 15, on these wretched gravel plains with their stunted vegetation, but the relationship of the Macrauchenia to the guanaco, now an inhabitant of the most sterile parts, partly explains this difficulty. The relationship, though distant, between the Macrauchenia and the guanaco, between the Toxodon and the Capybara, the closer relationship between the many extinct Edentata and the living sloths, anteaters, and armadillos, now so eminently characteristic of South American zoology, and the still closer relationship between the fossil and living species of Ctenomys and Hydrocheiras, are most interesting facts. This relationship is shown wonderfully, as between the fossil and extinct marsupial animals of Australia, by the great collection lately brought to Europe, from the caves of Brazil by M. Lund and Clausen. In this collection there are extinct species of all the 32 genera, excepting 4, of the terrestrial quadrupeds now inhabiting the provinces in which the caves occur, and the extinct species are much more numerous than those now living. There are fossil anteaters, armadillos, tapirs, peccaries, guanacos, opossums, and numerous South American gnawers, and monkeys, and other animals. This wonderful relationship in the same continent between the dead and the living will, I do not doubt, hereafter throw more light on the appearance of organic beings on our earth, and their disappearance from it, than any other class of facts. It is impossible to reflect on the changed state of the American continent without the deepest astonishment. Formerly it must have swarmed with great monsters, now we find mere pygmies, compared with the antecedent allied races. If Buffon had known of the gigantic sloth and armadillo, like animals, and of the lost Pachydermata, he might have said with a greater semblance of truth, that the creative force in America had lost its power, rather than that it had never possessed great vigor. The greater number, if not all, of these extinct quadrupeds lived at a late period, and were the contemporaries of most of the existing sea shells. Since they lived, no very great change in the form of the land can have taken place. What, then, has exterminated so many species and whole genera? The mind at first is irresistibly hurried into the belief of some great catastrophe, but thus to destroy animals, both large and small, in southern Patagonia, in Brazil, on the Cordillera of Peru, in North America, up to Bering Straits, we must shake the entire framework of the globe. An examination, moreover, of the geology of La Plata and Patagonia, leads to the belief that all the features of the land result from slow and gradual changes. It appears from the character of the fossils in Europe, Asia, Australia, and in North and South America, that those conditions which favor the life of the larger quadrupeds were lately coextensive with the world. What those conditions were, no one has yet even conjectured. It could hardly have been a change of temperature, which had about the same time destroyed the inhabitants of tropical, temperate, and Arctic latitudes on both sides of the globe. In North America we positively know from Mr. Lyell, that the large quadrupeds lived subsequently to that period, when boulders were brought into latitudes at which icebergs now never arrive, from conclusive but indirect reasons we may feel sure that in the southern hemisphere the Macrauchenia also lived long subsequently to the ice-transporting boulder period. Did man, after his first inroad into South America, destroy, as has been suggested, the unwieldy Megatherium and the other Edentata? We must at least look to some other cause for the destruction of the little Tucutuco at Bahia Blanca, and of the many fossil mice and other small quadrupeds in Brazil. No one will imagine that a drought, even far severer than those which cause such losses, in the provinces of La Plata, could destroy every individual of every species from southern Patagonia to Bering Straits. What shall we say of the extinction of the horse? Did those plains fail of pasture, which have since been overrun by thousands and hundreds of thousands of the descendants of the stock introduced by the Spaniards? Have the subsequently introduced species consumed the food of the great antecedent races? Can we believe that the capybara has taken the food of the toxodon, the guanaco, of the Macrauchenia, the existing small Edentata, of their numerous gigantic prototypes? Certainly, no fact in the long history of the world is so startling as the wide and repeated exterminations of its inhabitants. Nevertheless, if we consider the subject under another point of view, it will appear less perplexing. We do not steadily bear in mind how profoundly ignorant we are of the conditions of existence of every animal, nor do we always remember that some check is constantly preventing the too rapid increase of every organized being left in a state of nature. The supply of food, on an average, remains constant. Yet the tendency in every animal to increase by propagation is geometrical, and its surprising effects have nowhere been more astonishingly shown than in the case of the European animals run wild during the last few centuries in America. Every animal in a state of nature regularly breeds, yet in a species long established, any great increase in numbers is obviously impossible, and must be checked by some means. We are, nevertheless, seldom able with certainty to tell in any given species at what period of life, or at what period of the year, or whether only at long intervals, the check falls, or, again, what is the precise nature of the check. Hence probably it is that we feel so little surprise at one of two species closely allied in habits being rare and the other abundant in the same district, or, again, that one should be abundant in one district, and another, filling the same place in the economy of nature, should be abundant in a neighboring district, differing very little in its conditions. If asked how this is, one immediately replies that it is determined by some slight difference in climate, food, or the number of enemies. Yet how rarely, if ever, we can point out the precise cause and manner of action of the check. We are therefore driven to the conclusion that cause is generally quite inappreciable by us, determine whether a given species shall be abundant or scanty in numbers. In the cases where we can't trace the extinction of a species through man, either wholly or in one limited district, we know that it becomes rarer and rarer, and is then lost. It would be difficult to point out any just distinction between a species destroyed by man, or by the increase of its natural enemies. 8/13. See the excellent remarks on this subject by Mr. Lyell, in his Principles of Geology. The evidence of rarity preceding extinction is more striking in the successive tertiary strata, as remarked by several able observers. It has often been found that a shell very common in a tertiary stratum is now most rare, and has even long been thought to be extinct. If then, as appears probable, species first become rare, and then extinct, if the too rapid increase of every species, even the most favored, is steadily checked, as we must admit, though how and when it is hard to say, and if we see, without the smallest surprise, though unable to assign the precise reason, one species abundant, and another closely allied species rare in the same district, why should we feel such great astonishment at the rarity being carried a step farther to extinction? An action going on every side of us, and yet barely appreciable, might surely be carried a little farther without exciting our observation. Who would feel any great surprise at hearing that the Mogollonyx was formerly rare compared with the Megatherium, or that one of the fossil monkeys was few in number compared with one of the now living monkeys? And yet in this comparative rarity, we should have the plainest evidence of less favorable conditions for their existence. To admit that species generally become rare before they become extinct, to feel no surprise at the comparative rarity of one species with another, and yet to call in some extraordinary agent, and to marvel greatly when a species ceases to exist, appears to me much the same as to admit that sickness, in the individual, is the prelude to death, to feel no surprise at sickness, but when the sick man dies to wonder, and to believe that he died through violence. End of chapter 8.